In the United States, the most popular narrative we tell our K through 12 students is that when they graduate, they should go right into a four-year college program. The idea is that they can go to college, graduate in 4 years, get a nice job, and do the whole white picket fence thing. This narrative is quite effective, and 66.2% of those who graduated in 2019 enrolled in college. Today, we want to explore that narrative. We will do our best to objectively assess the validity of this story. Is it true that our students can easily go to college? And is it true that a college degree prepares them for a better life? What are the popular alternatives to college? And what are the benefits of these different routes that a young person could take? My name is Isaac Goff Mitchell, and this is The Youth Vote. You're listening to episode 4 in our Education in America series. Stay with us. So, before we get into the alternatives to college, and before we talk with the great guests we interviewed for this episode, I'm going to take some time to dive into the four-year college narrative. As I mentioned above, a huge amount of high school graduates go to college. It is incredibly important to note, though, this does not mean that they are all getting college degrees. While the data kind of varies depending on the sources, around 40% of those who attend college end up dropping out before they ever even graduate. You might be thinking, what's so bad about people dropping out? I mean, if they tried it and it wasn't for them, there's no harm in that, right? Well, the problem is that college is not cheap. In fact, 44.7 million Americans have student debt, which is about 1 in 4 people. The average amount of debt is just under $40,000, but some folks even have debt up into six figures. I know there have been lots of numbers thrown at you, so I want to break it down in a way we can all relate to and understand. The average monthly payment on student debt is just under $400 a month. Imagine the difference in your life having an extra $400 could have. That's the average cost of college. And how many people just can't afford that kind of a bill at all? Sure, there's some federal assistance available, we've all heard of FAFSA, but FAFSA typically does not cover a student's full tuition. There are lots of scholarships out there too, but the qualification requirements are typically pretty strict. Now, I don't want to make it seem like college is all bad. There are some obvious benefits to going to college, and it would be hypocritical of me to attack a four-year college degree, as I am one of those with a bachelor's degree, and I'm one of those on the higher end of that student debt spectrum. There are some huge benefits that we should break down before we get into the alternatives for college. But first, a short break.
Snap Sessions, a podcast with interviews of artists and activists from around the world,
political commentary, and deep dives into media and culture.
Snap Sessions has tributes to music and comedy stars
like Weird Al Yankovic, Monty Python, and Tom Lehrer,
and explores issues like voting rights, global climate change, and nuclear madness.
And yes, Snap Sessions has comedy too.
Snap Sessions, a podcast for people who like to think and love to laugh.
Find Snap Sessions at thesnapsessions.com.
Welcome back. Now, I know this episode has been a lot of my voice and not a lot of guests, so I want to make this part quick. We must acknowledge the benefits of getting a four-year college degree. For example, people with a four-year college degree are much less likely to be unemployed in their lifetime. Additionally, they gain access to networking through their university that oftentimes can lead to jobs that they might not otherwise have found. And lastly, one of the most important benefits of college is that people with a four-year college degree make between $23,000 and $24,000 more per year on average when compared with those who don't have a college degree. But all of this being said, I think we should look at some alternatives to the four-year college degree.
We're a training center. We're training students to enter the workforce, to have proven technical skills, to be a successful employee.
That was Joel King, the Director of Teaching and Learning at Great Oaks, a career and technical school in Cincinnati, Ohio. I explained to Joel that growing up, people told me that technical school or trade schools were just for future welders, electricians, and plumbers.
I mean, we have students who are going to become phlebotomists, who are going to become medical assistants. We have some students that are going to get their LPN. We have students that are able to complete their ASE student certifications for mechanics. We even have a few students who actually complete what would be the adult equivalent, the actual ASE certification for certain areas. We have a program at Laurel Oaks, which is our Wilmington campus. We're fortunate that there is an airport up there, and we actually have students who are completing their FAA 147. So they're able to go in and become employed right away. We have students that complete our firefighting program, so they can go right in as a firefighter, EMT program.
Joel explained that people who go to technical school can head directly into many different careers, ranging from EMTs to pilots, and they leave with real-world skills that help them in jobs which are vital to our society.
I tell people, so if you look at like a picture of an accident scene, a lot of the people that are responding to an accident scene may not have gotten a four-year degree, maybe got an associate's degree, but they have a very extensive and very intense technical skill training piece. And obviously we want that heaven forbid we have to have someone respond to something like that. You want those people that you know they've got the skills, they can respond and they can help. So it's kind of another way to think about that.
Beyond the skills these folks acquire, they are also setting themselves up for job security and financial well-being. Joel explained that many students who go through technical schools starting in high school end up graduating with no debt and are getting paid right after they graduate. I asked Joel what he thinks about the common narrative that high schoolers should all go to college.
But I think that narrative of college is kind of the only way you can go and be successful is changing. I think people are recognizing all of the different possibilities and all of the different pathways. Something we've talked a lot about is what we term as helping students find multiple entry and exit points. So I think that idea of I'm going to do this one thing and I'm going to do it for 40 or 45 years and I'm going to retire from that, I think that is changing. I think education in general, we're starting to realize everybody learns differently, and there is not this one size fits all.
Another thing he mentioned, which I thought was really important, is the way we talk to young people. He explained that instead of asking young people, where are you going to go to college, we should ask them, what are you passionate about? From their answer to that question, we could then guide them towards the options that best serve their needs. To fully explore the routes that students might take after graduating high school, we needed to look at one of the largest employers of young people in America. The most recent data said that there are 605,000 people in the U.S. Armed Forces between the age of 18 and 25.
So the demographic that the military as a whole looks for recruitment is the age between 18 and 24. That is, doesn't mean you can't be older than that.
That's Joan Sweeney. She has spent almost 26 years in the Army, ran for Ohio State Representative in 2020, and now she is teaching at a community college working with military veteran students. Before we got into the reasons why young people might want to enlist in the military, I asked her a bit about how military recruitment works.
So the military recruits where 18 to 24-year-olds are. And I say that not being flippant. I say that because it's just the same place that colleges recruit. And there is recruitment in the high schools, but there's also at clubs, at the malls when, you know, there aren't pandemics and people can go to malls. They're on the community colleges. But I do want to make a point that the military went to the all-volunteer recruiting force in 1973. And it wasn't until 2001 in the No Child Left Behind Act that military recruiters were allowed to then go into the high schools. So, I mean, that's 20 years old at this point, but a relatively recent development in the concept of a volunteer army.
This particular point was fascinating to me because I, as I'm sure so many other young people will relate to, saw military recruiters in my school all the time. So the military recruits wherever there are young people, but where do they focus geographically?
It's actually a very wide net, and it was a very deliberately designed wide net. Where propensity comes in is different. So a lot of times I think people confuse where we actually try to recruit and then where people are more propensed to join. And there is a higher propensity to join in one, some of our southern states, two, some rural and small town versus high density urban areas. And then three, in areas that are around military areas. And another reason that kind of drives everything, not everything, that drives some things towards the South is when they started doing the Base Realignment and Closure Act, they started condensing bases into bigger areas, into areas that had bigger land and more training opportunities. And the majority of those bases are in the South. So now you have more military installations throughout the Southern and Southwestern portion of the United States.
Joan explained that wherever there are military bases, there are more people joining the military. And obviously, there are a lot of young people who join the military, but it doesn't look the same for everybody. For example, some people enlist as active duty, while others join the Guard or the Reserve. Joan explained that the real difference here is the amount of time you put into it. So let's break it down. If someone enlists in the military and is active duty, that means that the military is their full-time job. They will train and work and live in the military until their time is up. If someone joins the Guard or the Reserves, they will usually do 1 weekend a month and then 2 full weeks per year of training. And at any time, people in the Guard or Reserve can be called into duty. Joan explains that this happened on a wide scale recently.
We know many of our guards and reserve individuals who were called up during the pandemic to work in food banks, medically to help manage tents and some triage and preparations from some very overwhelmed hospitals. So there's a lot of missions. During the hurricane season, a lot of the National Guard members are called up.
Joining the military is obviously a huge commitment, regardless of whether you do active duty or not. But there must be some benefits, right?
An individual who enlists now and serves for 36 months would be eligible to receive what is called the Forever GI Bill. It's the post 9/11 GI Bill, which pays for 36 months of school, of higher education, and gives you a monthly stipend.
On top of the GI Bill benefits, folks who join the military start getting paid instantly. They get health coverage, and they are given paid specialized job training. Additionally, they get many days off. This all sounds pretty nice, doesn't it? Well, Joan assured me that joining the military is not necessarily just an easy paycheck.
But yeah, there's an intensity to it. And there's an intensity, there is a purposeful intensity to it. And people are saying, well, they're just being mean. They're just being, you know, why do they have to be like that? On some degrees, you don't necessarily need to be mean, but you have to learn to be able to take commands and react, because, you know, regardless of the benefits that are offered, regardless of, what people want to give to the military or get from the military, they are warfighting organizations. So, you know, it is ultimately has a potential to be dangerous. And in so you have to ensure that you train people seriously. There's a mindset that, well, if I don't make it in college, I'll join the military. Or if I don't do this, I'll join the military. And I'm going to tell you, if you can't make it in college or if you can't make it at your job, you're absolutely not going to make it in the military.
You can clearly see from what Joan is saying here that the military isn't really for everybody. It is a tough gig, and it isn't a fallback for folks who couldn't do well enough in school. Additionally, she told me that in order to even join the military, you have to have a high school diploma or a GED, and you have to be deemed medically qualified. Joan also had some thoughts about that narrative we talked about, that high schoolers should all go to college.
I don't know when, but somewhere the funnel just kept pushing people towards four-year degrees, you know, to the detriment of our unions, to the detriment of apprenticeships and skilled trades, and you know, over time, probably to the detriment of the military. And I think there's education comes in so many facets, in so many ways, that just pushing, you know, that everyone's not a, you know, a round peg that fits into the hole. Everyone's got to have a different, people have different paths, so they should have different opportunities.
Opportunities. That is a word that both Joel and Joan use to describe what we should be giving to young people. And it's a mantra that America has always claimed to hold in great regard. We're supposed to be the land of opportunity. And perhaps that means we should stray away from the idea that every single young person needs to go to a four-year college program. As Joel and Joan said, every person is different, and maybe we should do a better job of showing people their different options. In this series so far, we have gone from the history of education in America to exploring what students can do when they are finished with their K-12 learning. Of course, we couldn't cover everything, but we hope that this series has helped to highlight some of the inequalities and the problems that we need to fix, but also shown some blips of positivity that give hope for a better future. Next week, we're going to wrap up this series by taking a look at the people who make education possible and exploring the ins and outs of their jobs and the struggles that they faced. You probably guessed it, we will be talking with teachers. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in next week. The Youth Vote is hosted by me, Isaac Goff Mitchell, produced by Jamie Hobbs, and social media is managed by Bridget Junker. The music for this series is produced by Jim Young.